Greetings to you, my sweet liquefying children of the earth. It is I, D. Truss, and you are listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour Podcast, a radiant obsidian pyramid rising above the sonic waters of the podcasting universe, blasting out great waves of telepathic, metaphysical, sonic, astral energy into the deepest part of your third eye, causing your brain to explode with love jizz all over the chest, face, feet, knees, and legs of the present moment. I welcome you into these great halls of glory and say hello. All right, here it goes, pals. The big announcement. I've been recording this intro since 9 a.m. It is now 9:21 p.m. And this is it. I'm uploading this no matter what. But I've been trying to think of like some perfect way to say it. Like, I wish that I had the power to summon an angel to fly into my stomach and put its mouth through my throat and into my mouth so that I could talk about this in a perfect, angelic, beautiful, poetic, sweet, glorious, life-affirming way. But I don't. There isn't an angel in my body. There's just a half a burrito and a kale salad in there. So I'm going to just like use that to talk about. I just went through a breakup. A four-year relationship just ended. And, you know, relationships don't end all at once. When a relationship ends, it's a form of death and it dies like most things die, kind of slowly in phases. But, you know, it ended recently, like officially it was over in New York as I'm packing up my stuff. We did the final matter exchange. If you've ever been in a long-term relationship or a short-term relationship, you probably know about the matter exchange. It is a unrecognized ritual in the end of a relationship where you give the final little bit of stuff that's congealed in your apartment to them and they give the final little stuff of yours that they have, and there's this weird exchange where you're like, okay, here's your boots and your camera. And they're like, all right, here's your sweatshirt and the shirt I got you. And then that's it. The door shuts and it's over. It's done. Now, at that point, you've got a really interesting situation on your hands because something you've gotten very used to for 4 years just ended, right? And so you're going to go through some crazy feelings and you might send some weird texts and some weird texts might be sent to you and there might be some weird moments. But ultimately, if you really think about it, you're doing great. And I think this is what gets left out. And I think there's a cultural sort of, I don't know, there's like a cultural like gravity towards overdoing the grief when something ends. I'm not saying there shouldn't be grief. I'm not saying that on the way to the airport I didn't spring a leak listening to Rocky Votolato's White Daisy Passing, which is one of the great breakup songs of all time. I'm not saying that there hasn't been like a sullen sadness, moments of anger, moments of regret, but ultimately, I feel pretty good, and it was the right thing. And I think it's the right thing for her. And based on what I've heard from her, she's doing good. It's good. Ultimately. And I think there's like a weird cultural gravity when shit ends to like overdo it. To start listening to Elliott Smith. To like get into like the hate side of things. Get into the grief side. Get way more into the grief side than you need to get. When a relationship ends, it's a death. And we, in this part of the planet, the way we deal with death is fucking weird. Like, we gotta put it in you gotta hide it away, sweep it under the rug, don't talk about it, put it in the hospice. You gotta be careful if someone's dying, oh God, or someone around them is dying, oh Jesus. You gotta treat them so carefully when it's the most natural thing. It's exactly how things should be. Things liquefy, things transform, things shift. It's meant to be that way. And in the past, oh my God, I've gotten so overwrought. You know, like getting into the idea maybe that, getting into the fantasy that they're miserable without you, right? I mean, there's like Elliott Smith songs dedicated to that. Elliott Smith, you know, he's got like at least 70 breakup songs. All of them daggers slung at some poor emaciated hipster girl who like just was like, look, man, you're like, I've been on the receiving end of your flaccid heroin cock for too long. I gotta go. And he like writes these like just beautiful songs of anger. Like, here's a good one. Somebody that I used to know. I had tender feelings that you made hard. But it's your heart, not mine, that's scarred. So when I go home, I'll be happy to go. You're just somebody that I used to know. You don't need my help anymore. It's all now to you. There ain't no before. Now that you're big enough to run your own show, you're just somebody that I used to know. I watched you deal in a dying day and throw a living past away so you can be sure that you're in control. You're just somebody that I used to know. I know you don't think you did me wrong, and I can't stay this mad for long, keeping a hold of what you just let go. You're just somebody that I used to know. Like, I've listened to that song, chewing Vicodin like ice cubes, fantasizing that whoever just broke up with me, or whoever I broke up with, is miserable somewhere. When the truth is, they're having the greatest week of their that they've had in years. They don't have to deal with your sullen Edgar Allan Poe, quoth the raven nevermore, ass. They're free. They're hanging out with some cool guy who they have no history with, getting to know them, realizing like, oh my God, I could have a whole other life other than the one I was just in. Meanwhile, you're like some dark warlock clutching a skull in the bottom of a tower, casting curses. And that, I think that's not the way to do it. I'm not saying don't experience your grief, don't experience your sadness, but just make sure you're actually sad. Make sure you're actually experiencing grief, because it may be that you're secretly happy and you think that you shouldn't be. That can happen. You might be reacting to the way people around you are acting. Because when you go through a breakup, you might actually be getting off on people being like, oh my God, are you okay? Or you might be sort of being reactive to the way people around you are acting. Because a few people have like said in different ways to me, like, man, I hope you're doing all right. I really do. And they look at me like I just fell on a mortar. They look at me like I'm laying in some muddy World War II swamp with my guts in my hands, drinking whiskey out of a flask while I'm just shitting blood out of my half decapitated ass. And it's just not, that's not what's happening. It's really made me realize we've got to be like, what, the next time I get around somebody who's going through some kind of loss, I am not going to wince. Because you just don't know what's happening with somebody. You just don't know. It could be that things are great. This is what I think. I think we should spend double on the divorce party than what we spend on the marriage. When people get married, whatever you spend on the marriage, when you get divorced, there should be a huge party that you spend double what you spent on the marriage. There should be fireworks. There should be ships launching butterflies into the sky. There should be sprays of rare perfume. Everyone should be dancing. Because this is a new life that's opening up for you. You did it. You went through the dance with someone. You spent some time, good and bad, with someone. It didn't work out necessarily. But God damn it, it doesn't mean that you have to spend the next year in recovery. It doesn't mean that you have to spend like month after month mourning and sad and wearing fucking black. I think that's sick. I think that's a lack of understanding in the way the universe actually works, which is, let's face it, sweet friends, we're being liquefied by time. The house that you're in, the apartment that you're in, the clothes that you're wearing, the car that you're driving, and they're going to be around lots longer than your meaty little sweet smelling little body's going to be. Your clothes are going to end up in a thrift store or the dump. Your house is going to be inhabited by many other families. You're essentially a sentient vapor floating through time. Everything else around you is going to last, but you, no, you're drifting into the infinity. You're just spreading out. You're vaporizing. And that's beautiful. And so when like things really shift in a person's life or in your life, I think it's cause for celebration. So the next time you find yourself at the end of a relationship, let yourself grieve. I'm not saying to block out the feelings of sadness. Go through the sadness. Go through the melodrama. Do the weird texts. Have the moments of anger. Have the moments of like confrontation. Have the moments of say whatever you need to say. But make sure you don't stretch that out longer than it needs to be stretched out to satisfy the expectation of people around you. Like a child who's fallen and like notices an adult looking at them in horror and starts screaming, because that can happen too. We need to do butterfly releases when people end a relationship. There needs to be tap dancing and champagne and back rubs, ecstatic orgies, MDMA injections, big blasts of ketamine and float tank sessions. Not Elliot Smith and Vicodin. Because sometimes, all the time, things end. It's beautiful. That being said, I got to find a fucking place in Los Angeles. So if anybody knows of a place in LA, I'm looking for a place in the Atwater Village, Silver Lake area at around 3K, 4K max. And for that amount, I expect to get some kind of mansion with at least 6 acres, some kind of subterranean limestone cave with ancient casks of fine wine. I'm looking for a place with an indoor pool and a solarium. Also, and this isn't a deal breaker, but I would prefer for the place to have some kind of family graveyard from the previous family that I can take future lovers on walks through on moonlit nights. Some kind of like secret doorway in the house that leads to a section of the limestone cave that leads to a labyrinth with a codex and a golden box that contains within it my future life that I have to get decoded by some kind of archaeologist that slowly drives me mad, but I recover from it. And from the recovery, I have more wisdom and joy than I've ever had before. Okay, babies, we're going to jump right into this episode with Luis Gomez, Luis J. Gomez, premier comedian, premier prime New York comedian, a true sweetie, a really funny dude. But first, some quick biznaz. May the blessings of the eternal son of Lothlorien and your attention fall upon today's sweet sponsors. Big thanks to TrackArt.com for sponsoring this episode. Do you always lose your wallet, your phone, your keys? Are you someone who, much like me, has been inhaling ganja and eating ganja for the last 20 years of your life, and now you've gained some secret telekinesis where when you're not looking, some deep part of your subconscious mind actually moves your wallet and your phone and your keys to places that you didn't leave them? Well, I've got the answer for you, friends. It's the TrackR. The TrackR. 8 years ago, TrackR changed everything when they released their first tracking device, and now they've done it again with a new TrackR Pixel. When you misplace an item that has a TrackR Pixel attached, use your smartphone, and a 90 decibel alert will help you find it in seconds. It has a powerful LED light, so you can find anything, even in the dark. Lose your phone? Just press the button on your TrackR Pixel and your phone rings, even if it's on silent. You can locate your item even if it's miles away, because every TrackR user is part of the largest crowd locate network in the world. It's like Waze for finding your things. And TrackR's 30-day money-back guarantee means you truly have nothing to lose. They'll give you your money back. Give it a shot. This is the future, friends. Go to the TrackR.com. That's TrackR.com. Enter promo code Duncan to get 20% off any order. That's the TrackR.com promo code Duncan for 20% off. The TrackR.com promo code Duncan. This is a really cool thing, man. I don't know if you guys lose shit all the time, but I certainly do. And it works. It makes this high-pitched shrieking sound. You can always find your phone. You know, weirdly, I do keep track of my wallet because it's either in my pocket or on my bedside table. But my phone, holy fuck, man. That can end up in the poodle's asshole, you know? Classic problems. Press the button on the TrackR device and your phone makes a noise so you can find it. And if you lose whatever you stuck your TrackR on, then You can use your phone to find the son of a gun. This solves one of the great problems of our age, which is that marijuana is becoming legal. And we're going to lose stuff a little bit more. But thanks to the folks over at TrackR.com, you can find whatever you have lost. Also, you sick, sick, sick people. We got to stop eating out, man. All I do is shove fast food and takeout down my throat or go to restaurants and eat oysters. And the vibes of the chef soak into the food and you get the karma of the chef, man. That's what I read in a Hare Krishna book years ago. And I think it may be true. This is where today's sponsor, HelloFresh, comes in. HelloFresh, it's the meal kit delivery service that makes cooking more fun so you can focus on the whole experience, not just the final plate. Each week, HelloFresh creates new delicious recipes with step-by-step instructions designed to take around 30 minutes for everyone from novices to seasoned home cooks short on time. And it's less than $10 a meal. I've used HelloFresh. I don't advertise anything on this show that I don't like, and it's super cool. You feel like you're on one of those cooking shows, and I was fully prepared for it to be too complex for me. I do ruin recipes when I cook, usually. I need help when I'm cooking. I never got into cooking, and so it needs to be broken down in the most simple way for me, and HelloFresh does that. They divide everything up. It's super fresh ingredients, it's easy to follow instructions, and sure as shit, you will end up mixing a glorious plate of delicious food that will be stunning to you and your date, who will immediately withdraw her clothes, who will rip her shirt open, he will tear his shirt open and love you. She will fall in love with you in that moment as she spoons the delicious meal that you constructed. Or maybe even better, you make a meal with your love. You make a meal with your new love to solidify your bond. You put your joy into this food and you eat it before consummating your love, before making your first child. Your first child will be made of HelloFresh. For $30 off of your first week of HelloFresh, go to HelloFresh.com and enter in Duncan30. It's the new moon, friends, and that means starting a new cycle. And that means stopping, slurping back that gruel you've been shoveling into your mouth that was created by some kind of psychotic chef in some kitchen covered in rat feces and swastikas. Start making your own food. Learn how to cook. So that when the great meteor smashes into the earth or Yellowstone explodes or the aliens come, you'll be able to spend the last few weeks of your existence making delicious food with the fresh ingredients you were growing in your apocalypse garden. HelloFresh.com, offer code Duncan30. Please support them because they support us. Speaking of supporting us, infinite gratitude to those of you who continue to subscribe to our Patreon page, which is at patreon.com/DTFH. If you want early access to interviews that are commercial free, if you want opening rambling monologues that don't have any commercials, if you want to dive into the deep inner helix of the DTFH, this is the place to go. patreon.com/DTFH. For $5 a month, you get early access to all the interviews, commercial free. For $2, you get a bunch of opening monologues and rambles and rants. But most importantly, what you get is the knowledge that you are my patron, my master, that you own me, that I must kneel down before you. I must lick your toes. I must offer you everything that I have and respect your firm yet soft hand as it spanks me for some offense. Remember, patreon.com/DTFH. Become a patron of the podcast that George W. Bush said changed his life and helped him understand the terrible things that he did when he went to war in Iraq. Remember, patreon.com/DTFH. Finally, much thanks to those of you who use our Amazon portal. If you want to buy something cool on Amazon, like some modular synthesizers or toilet paper and a bidet, why don't you go through the Amazon link, which is located at duncantrussell.com. It's all over dunkandtrussell.com. Just scroll down in any of these episodes, click on that link, go through Amazon, and they'll give us a small percentage of anything that you buy. My loves, thank you so much for listening to this long opening intro. I love you guys. I wanted to share this crazy news that just happened to me. Sorry if I'm rambling or weird, but I guess nothing has changed because this is what I'm always like. Today's guest is a really funny comedian that I became friends with in New York. He is a member of the notorious and esteemed Legion of Skanks. He also has his own podcast called The Real Ass Podcast, and he's somebody that I had a lot of great times with during my brief stint in the Big Apple. So everybody, please, open your hearts, expand your mind, envelop this glorious being, this comedic entity, this thunderbolt of truth, so that he can feel the tendrils of your astral body wrapping around him. Everyone, please, welcome to the DTFH, Louis J. Gomez. Louis, welcome to the DTFH. Thank you so much for being here, man.
Thanks for having me, buddy.
Dude, how was L.A.? You were just out there, right?
Yeah, it was great. I loved it. I love L.A. I don't know why people hate L.A.
Do you go out there a lot?
Yeah, I go out probably now like 4 or 5 times a year. I was going out like 2 or 3 times a year. My buddy Nate Borgazzi, who is my son's godfather, really funny comic.
Yeah.
He told me a few years ago, he was like, dude, no matter what, even if you don't have things going on, just go out to L.A., plan a trip. You'll have meetings that are set up around it. You want to be seen in both worlds. You just want to be a guy that's working in both places. So, yeah, I just kind of made an excuse to go out a few times a year.
You are a driven comedian. It is so cool, man. You're super funny. You've got this amazing work ethic. You're part of this. What would you call the Skanks? Is it a collective?
Yeah, I mean, Legion of Skanks, the podcast itself, it kind of has like, it's grown into almost, I would say similar to what the Death Squad thing is out on the West Coast.
Yeah.
Kind of like, you know, a group of comedians that are sort of loosely associated with that as well and that brand. And we've turned it into the comedy festival, Skankfest.
It's huge. That thing, it was insane, man.
Yeah.
Like, so many people. I've never seen a comedy festival where people are giving out tattoos.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, and you know this because you podcast. I think when you do this and people that connect with this type of content, I think they fucking love it. They love it a lot more than they just love stand-up, or they love it a lot more than they love their favorite TV show. They're fucking living it with you.
People were getting Legion of Skanks logo tattooed on their bodies, and they weren't thinking about it. They were just doing it.
Yeah, it's also a cool logo. If we had a shitty logo, I think it would be a lot harder to sell. But when, you know, the podcast comes and goes, and it will one day, you have that little symbol. It's like, what was that? Well, you know, that was a period in your life where you listened to this thing every single week. You know, podcasts, they get people through some pretty fucked up times, I think. This is what I hear the most, that we get, like, you know, letters from people that are like, dude, you know what? I was going through some shit. You know, my wife left me, my fucking kid was taken away, whatever it is. You guys kept me laughing week in, week out, you know, and, you know, for me, I think whether the podcast itself, who gives a shit, but if it's a cool little symbol that can kind of, you look down and it reminds you of that, you know, I don't think there's any regret there. I think when it's a fucking, I don't know, man, I guess maybe people feel the same way about like a Yankees logo or
right.
something like that. I always felt that way when I saw somebody with like tattooing a sports team on their arm. I'm like, dude, grow up. I don't know, dude. You're like, you're living like you're, but maybe they have that story too. You know, maybe it reminds me of them, of their dad fucking bringing them to, you know, the baseball game on Sundays. And that's a big thing for them. So it's not as, you know, it's not as simple as like, oh, look at that douchebag. He loves the Yankees that much. He's got to have a fucking symbol on his arm.
But you guys like have like a hardcore community around you. I mean, the Death Squad has that too, but I think that, I don't know, it's such a specific cult that you've built up. It's like you have this, and I use cult as a positive.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful thing.
I take it as a positive.
Yeah. But how did, I want to talk about how this started. Yeah. I want to talk about the beginning of the Skanks and like how it kind of grew to suddenly being this thriving group of people who have no problem tattooing your logo into their flesh. Does that weird you out, man? That people are like, your logo is going to be moldering in some coffin?
No.
Well, with your fans, probably in a few months.
Yeah, yeah. Does it weird you out that there's probably people that are dead on the floor of their apartment with heroin needles sticking out of their arms with your tattoo on them? No, you know, it doesn't weird me out. I don't know, man. I think when I got into comedy, I got into it, when I got into entertainment, I was in a band when I was a teenager. I've kind of, even before it was, I think, a part of our generation, I think the generation below us, like everyone wants to be a rock star. Everybody wants to be a professional athlete or a musician or whatever. Everybody, every kid now, you know?
Yeah.
And I still kind of wanted that. And I grew up really poor and I grew up, you know, I think.
Where'd you grow up? New York?
I grew up in like an hour outside of the city. So I always kind of wanted to be an entertainer. I liked entertaining people. I got up on stage pretty young. I was a teenager when I started playing drums in a band. So now when I have people tattooing my fucking logo on their arm and I see that, dude, I think it's the coolest thing in the world. I think maybe not every comic feels this way. When people come up to me in public and tell me they appreciate what I do, I mean, it's the greatest feeling in the world. If you ever see me, and you know who I am, and you don't fucking say, oh, hey, Louis J. Gomez, I'm a fan of your work, go fuck yourself. You are not doing it. We are comics, and we are narcissists, and we do it because we want to feel great. You know, we want to feel great in that moment, but we also want to feel great offstage, afterwards. You know, you know, you talk about like a high. You get the on stage in that moment, that 15 minutes is that fucking high, right? You're like, whoa, I'm through the roof, right? Yeah. But you still want to be a little high at all times, you know? So you check Facebook or Twitter or...
Right.
You still want to get that high, you know?
Yeah.
So look, bitch, if I'm at the airport and you can fucking come up to me and be like, dude, I think you were so funny on that thing you did, I'm fucking back right there on stage in that moment again.
That's right.
You know what I'm saying? That's like a fucking, that's incredible. And most comics that I know, even if they won't admit it, I feel like they feel that way.
Of course. And talk, what do you think about those assholes who, when it happens, when someone comes up to them and is like, hey, what's up? And they reject the person. Yeah. That's one of the most demented forms of behavior on planet Earth, which is to act as though you sort of accidentally got famous, and now you're having to deal with this like atrocious problem of people coming to you and telling you they love you.
Yeah, that's like the biggest problem in your life.
Oh, those are the fires of hell for you, I guess. Yeah. And that thing, the whole tortured famous person, is to me one of the most disgusting forms of narcissism out there.
Yeah.
And narcissism, whatever. You end up being a narcissist, you're a narcissist. And accepting love is giving love. But when you're rejecting love and you've simultaneously put yourself in a position where people are going to come up and love you.
And you're reaping the benefits of all that love. So you have a house and a car and all these amazing things because these people love you and are willing to spend money on you.
Yeah.
Maybe not even in a direct way, but, you know, people the love you're talking about is why the network is willing to give you millions of dollars. Because they go, okay, America is going to sit around their TV sets and they're going to fucking have their eyes on you and they're going to fucking want you to win. And we're going to pay you for that. That's what they're paying you for, is those people wanting you to fucking win. That's why they're tuning in. They're rooting for you. You're Superman, right?
Yeah.
So for you to reject that, you know, I disagree with it, but it's also your right. We're human beings. You know, I always love that Charles Barkley quote. I don't know the exact quote, so I don't want to misquote him, but he just says how I never chose to be a role model. You know, athletes are kind of thrust. I think especially brown athletes and women, especially Ronda Rousey, I saw it happen with. She's a female mixed martial artist. They're almost like they end up having to be symbols of their skin color or their sex, if they're gay, like they have to be a leader for that community.
Right.
You know, it's like, well, Ronda Rousey, that I think that was part of the pressure with her, where it's like, not only does she just have to win, you know, she's an Olympic athlete, she knows pressure, but now she has little girls around the world going like, I'm looking up to you. And like every move you make, I'm looking, that type of scrutiny and everybody, you know, Anytime you have an opinion about anything about social issues or politics, you know, they fucking come at you. No matter what, you're gonna piss off 50% of the people in the world. That type of thing, I think, ends up, you know, crushing a lot of people. And I think that's what happened with her in particular.
Right. Yeah, I know people who get pretty ripped up by getting to a certain level of fame. Like, you do get to some level of fame where it becomes like you're in a dream you can't wake up from, like some weird dream where you've attracted all these mirrors of yourself. Like, suddenly you're everywhere you look, there's all these reflections of you in front of you. And that could be odd if you're not prepared for it. But
you also watch people not really treat you. There's not a real thing. I've noticed it on I'm not famous at all, but I've booked comedy shows, right? I started out booking comedy shows. And I watch people, because you have something that they want, they treat you differently, you know, and you kind of get this sense. I remember I did comedy for a couple of years. My first couple of years I did stand-up, I was terrible, and I was booking shows, so nobody was really telling me I was terrible. They were trying to get on my shows.
Right.
I had no real friends. Oh, yeah. I had no real friends.
Oh, I hear what you're saying.
Everyone was like trying to, you know.
This is what, okay, right. So what you're talking about, which is that you're not having any authentic contact with people. There's no one there to tell you, hey, man, you're being a dick right now.
Yep.
You're just surrounded by this, like, the worst kind of funhouse mirror is, instead of showing you in, like, absurd ways, which is what good friends will do, they'll reflect you and make fun of you. And through that, you might see something they're seeing that you might need to work on or something like that. But if you start getting around funhouse mirrors that are reflecting you more beautiful than you actually are. Not that you need to accept the beauty you're at, not like imagine you're more beautiful than you are, or like shining to you some version of yourself that isn't real, but it's in the positive, and you're going to start.
Or if you're the person that's kind of creating those reflections, that's okay. I think if, like, you're the person that's saying, you know what, I'm looking at myself and I am, you know, I'm looking at myself as being in a better place than I was. It's a state of mind.
Sure.
I think that's great. But if you're just going based off of the perception of other people around you, you have to understand everyone has their own ulterior motives. Everyone's got something else going on. So if you're letting other people kind of, the people, we watch it happen all the time in comedy. You're like, everyone's like, oh, what's that guy getting? Dude, let me tell you something. That guy that's getting everything, he's not. He's depressed. He's pissed. It's just what you're seeing on social media. He's showing you the better version of himself. So what happens is I'm holding myself up to that example, which isn't even real.
Yeah.
That guy's fucking...
It's fucking evil.
That guy's broke too. That guy is, worried about his next TV appearance.
This is what I want to talk to you about, man. So this is what I think is really cool about the skanks. Because one of the things you were talking about is, like, yeah, you get on TV and then suddenly you, like, people, you're out in the world and people see you and they are seeing an absurd version of you. Most people on TV, Jimmy Fallon, Jimmy Kimmel, even as intimate as Kimmel wants to get.
Yeah.
The reality is, the way we understand any of these people that we see all the time is in a suit, generally keeping to this very repetitive persona, a very specific rhythm in the way they talk. You know, this sort of inflatable thing that comes out in front of the cameras and can't really talk about how they actually feel.
Whereas,
that's an old thing. But you guys are the new thing that's happening, which is, here are three people who, more than likely, if we fly you back in time to the 80s and people are trying to pick hosts for their show, they're not going to be like, oh yeah, let's take these foul-mouthed, hilarious, raw humans and put them in front of the camera, because they're going to think, there's no way I could sell fucking diapers with these guys as hosts.
Right.
But now that we're in this beautiful new era, suddenly what's happening is people like you are getting, I don't know, if I mean, fuck fame, it's a stupid word anyway, but getting the success that used to be reserved for people who went through the network system, which was a filtration system that you had to get through. And even if you were like, even if you somehow fit the symmetrical characteristics, if you were aggressive yet adjustable, you know what I mean? If you were like something that could be reined in by the corporatocracy, then there would be 19 others just like you. And so it's still a 1 in 19 roll of the dice,
right?
Maybe. So I love the way that groups like you are coming to prominence because it's a way that is probably unlikely just 15 years ago.
Yeah, I think it's also sort of cyclical. I think that we're at the beginning of the internet, like content industry. You know, we're it's like the Wild West right now. You see it with podcasts and advertising. I mean, like, the way it all works, people don't even know, like, it's a fucking mess behind the scenes. There's no real, like, we can't technically use a licensed song, but they don't have any system to kind of go after people for really doing it
yet.
It's coming. I'd say, yeah, you heard me. We said yet at the exact same second, because it's coming. And it will, and it's coming, and we were just talking before the show happened about certain things behind the scenes, where it's like, they're figuring out now, okay, this is an industry, this is not the fucking Wild West, and that there's going to be restrictions put on the way.
Scary.
Yeah, so I think right now, it's kind of like, it's very punk rock, and it's very cool, and we are also coming out of a time where, you know, TV has been king forever, and everyone's been trying to get TV, and comedians in particular have been kind of whittled down to, you know, 10% of what is funny about them. And it's just like, okay, well, we have to have this very specific opinion. We don't want to piss anybody off. We have to, you know, appeal to the left.
Right.
And I think that it's become, you know, at this point, comedy a couple of years ago was almost like people rolling their eyes. Even on Comedy Central, it was the same way that people were going, oh, there's no music on MTV like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Like, what does MTV stand for? There's no music. Comedy Central stopped being stand-up, like, altogether. Like, there was no stand-up for a little while. They tried to do it, and it's like, nobody's watching it. Like, it's very, very strange. It kind of still is like that, but I do think there's this, like, new punk rock thing that's happening. And Owen Benjamin, you know, he said this on Legion of Skanks last week. Like, there's this new alternative to comedy today, which is people are just saying what they want. And who are going like, well, no, I'm going to explore funny in a way that I want to find funny. And the funniest people we all knew, everyone listening right now, remember, think back to the funniest kid in middle school, elementary school.
Sure.
He wasn't a kid who was sitting there with a notepad going, let me construct what's funny about this. Let me really overthink what's hilarious. It was the fucking kid who was from the gut funny.
Yeah.
It was a kid who would stand up on the lunchroom table. He was a kid.
Was that you?
That was me, yeah.
You were that
kid? I was
kid?
The funniest motherfucker. I was funnier than I've ever been in my entire life when I was a kid. And then it became, you know, a business. And you become like, you know, you do whatever. We can be talking, right? And let's say I'm having a conversation with you. And podcasting changed it a little bit because now we have microphones in front of us, right? But if I'm talking to you at a bar or a diner, right? And then one of us say something really funny. And then I'm like, oh, shit, dude, I can use that on stage. I will stop our conversation. I will stop this amazing, incredible, beautiful moment where we are enjoying each other's fucking time. I'm looking at you in your eyes. We are fucking connecting. I made you laugh, which is a fucking incredible thing that only certain people in the world have that ability to make their friends and family laugh. This is incredible. And I'll say, stop, hold the presses, fuck life. I have to go write this down now in a notebook.
Right.
And that, I believe that takes you're stopping exercising that funny muscle in life. That's how you get really, really funny, is you're making your friends laugh in life. You know, you fucking make a girl laugh on a date, whatever it is. And I think that we stop it. And I do think podcasting is kind of helping it again, though, because now we're talking so much and trying to be funny so often for so many hours a week that I think, once again, it's just exercising the muscle.
So you started off living outside of New York. Poor family.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Like, what do you mean by, oh, yeah, poor?
I don't think you realize how poor you are until you grow up a little bit and you look back and you're like, whoa, I was really poor. Like, my mom was on welfare, food stamps, Section 8. Mom was a former drug addict who was in recovery throughout my childhood. Didn't even know, really, that my mom was a drug addict. You know, apartments, never owned anything, never had a new car. Like, it was always some old beat up fucking car from the 80s.
Your parents got divorced?
My dad was murdered when I was 4. He was stabbed to death. So, he in Paterson, New Jersey, which is like.
Sorry, man.
No, it's okay, dude. You know, it's literally 30 years ago, 35 years, 31 years ago. So, my mom's 20 when she has me, 18 when she has my sister. You know, her husband or her boyfriend is murdered. Now she's left without these kids. She already had a drug problem.
Did they ever catch the murderer?
Yeah, he went to jail. I tried to get him on my podcast.
What?
I was going to try to get him on my pod because he went to jail for
you
like 20 years.
You tried to get
your
dad's killer on your podcast.
I did a whole thing. I talked to like a private investigator. They were sending me like specific things about the case because not everything's out there. So I went out and I did the research and found out a lot of information about the guy. He died. He died a few years ago. I was going to try to get him on and I wasn't going to like ambush him and be like, you fucking murdered my dad. He was a kid. My dad beat him up. He was like 16 and my dad beat him up probably in front of his girlfriend or some shit. Right. And he came back and he came back with a kitchen knife and there's no justification, but when you grow up in Paterson, New Jersey, you know, that's fucking dude. You look on the lists of the most dangerous places, dude. Paterson's been up there with like fucking Syria. It's like crazy, wow. Dude. Like it's not good, right? It's bad. And these little pockets of like Jersey are like, there's really bad neighborhoods in New Jersey and like outside of Philly. And yeah, my dad was also not a good dude. I don't think, he was kind of a bad, you know, drug dealer-y type, but also young, but he was like 25 or 26. And this guy, they got into a fist fight outside of a strip club and my dad got the better of him. And the guy came back later on that night and fucking stabbed him.
Holy shit.
And that was that. So it was like, hey, like literally came back with his friend. You know, his friend, you know, I guess they were with a girl. The girl threw the knife underneath a car. It was like all the details are fucking. They sent me like every like police report. I went on Google Earth and I like looked at the corner. That's eerie. That was the eeriest thing of all. Looking at the corner that he was stabbed on.
I can't imagine.
Yeah.
I can't imagine.
Yeah.
Wow.
So my mom,
So your poor mom, she's 24 now?
She was, 24.
Yeah, she's 24. You're 4. You said you had a sister?
Yeah, she's at 6 at the time.
So she has a 4 and a 6-year-old, and your dad just got murdered.
Yep.
And she's recovering from drugs, or is she using at the time?
She's recovering, but then she started using again after
he died. What
was
she taking?
Heroin.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Wow. And your dad was probably selling heroin.
Yeah.
And your dad was probably shooting heroin.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I didn't know any of this until I was like fucking 12 or 13. And it was because my mom used to take methadone, which is a drug they get for people in recovery. And it used to come in a little orange bottle.
Sure.
And I didn't know it. And my mom told me it was her back medication. And I was just watching the news with her one night. And on a conveyor belt, like the little bottles from my kitchen, just fucking new miracle drug to help heroin addicts.
Oh
that's
God.
Going to take the place of methadone. And it's like these little bottles. I remember It was like, you know, one of those big factories where it's like all of the bottles like came spinning down, like they were all spinning on a track.
Wow.
And it was like, I mean, that it's a very morbid like memory, those bottles spinning on that thing.
Whoa.
And me like looking over at my mom and like having the realization, like, holy fuck. And it hurt.
Was she aware? Did she know you'd figured her out at that point?
Yeah, I got mad.
What'd she say?
I don't remember, really. To be honest, I don't really remember what her reaction was. Maybe she denied it. Maybe then she told me afterwards. Yeah, I don't really remember.
You're 13.
Maybe anywhere between. I was probably between 11 and 13, sometime around that time.
Right. And so now it's dawning on you that your mom is struggling with this demon.
Yeah.
And it's continuing to struggle. Or was it that time, was she clean?
At that time, she was clean. She got, after my dad died, she started using again. And then me and my sister moved in with my aunt and my grandma. And then she started using it, you know, she was using. And then she got clean after like a year. She came and like lived with us. And then we moved back in with her.
How long were you apart from, do you remember that period of living with your grandmother?
I do. I don't remember. It didn't seem like... You know, look, dude, I it's so hard to kind of like, that time in your life is so weird, right? Because I have a 4-year-old now. It's such a fucked up time of life. That time of life is like, you know, it's your first memories. It's the first shit you fucking remember. And I remember when I had my kid, I was like, dude, when my kid's 4, I got to be making money. I got to be on TV.
Right.
I got to be successful. He's not going to have a memory of his dad being a loser.
Right.
So.
And his dad isn't. You're a hard-working human, man. You really have your shit together. It's amazing. Like, watching you, it seems like you're kind of like, I mean, I don't want to insult anybody else in the Skanks, but it seems like you're kind of like the brains behind a lot of it. You seem really like, you're so good at planning shit and coming up with, like, every time we're around, like, I'll say something just offhandedly that I would, like, never in a million years think of doing, and suddenly you're like coming up with business plans for
it. Yeah. Yeah, I think that just came from when you grow up that poor. I mean, we, like I said, dude, like I remember watching my mom at like 7 and being like, I don't know, we shouldn't be on welfare. You shouldn't be taking food stamps. I just remember having this thought, like being like, what are you doing? Like, what, like, that's not right. Like, what, like, what do we now? Look, now you go like, fucking the amount of taxes they take, motherfucker, give my money back, dude.
Right.
Do whatever you can do. Go take advantage, motherfuckers.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
But the reality is, you know, I think that, you know, it was the opposite thing. My mom was very verbally and physically abusive. My mom was very, like, you know, to be honest, very lazy for whatever reason, whether it was justified or not. You know, she didn't have that same type of drive or a thing. And I just didn't want to be like my mom. You know, I really didn't want to be like that. I've worked every day since I was 11 years old. I've always had a job. I was buying my own school clothes when I was 11 or 12 years old. I've had this industrious thing in me. And I was very embarrassed about being poor as well. So I think that kind of just, it was just this thing that was always built into me.
How's your relationship with your mom now?
She died.
Wow.
She died when I was like 22.
Wow. So you've had like...
You don't want to know how.
Yeah, I do.
Heroin overdose. She ended up using again after all said and done.
So it's weird hearing you talk about this because most comedians have had really great childhoods and a great life.
You know, it's funny though. It's like, you know, it's hack to say, but we're a sum of our fucking past and, you know, it is what it is. You know, I mean, I have literally the greatest kid in the world. I wouldn't change anything, dude. Would you bring your mom back? Fuck her. I don't like, not even in a negative way, dude. Not one. I wouldn't change a second before my son was born. Nothing,
wow,
dude. Because anything I could, the fucking wind blows another way, another day. I turn left when I should have turned right. Who knows where the fuck I could have been?
Right.
Even all that, dude. All these stupid things. You know, I love the idea of like chaos theory and the butterfly effect and all that shit. I get so like, I'm a stupid salesman, dude. I sold gym memberships and I always break down to like the core level of like all that shit.
Yeah.
Like, that was the thing that always got me into like sales was that like mentality behind it, right?
Yeah.
And I've just always like felt that way, dude. Like any little stupid thing, a fist fight you got into when you were in the fourth grade. You know, I remember I got to, in the sixth grade, I got to fight with Brian Schultz, right?
Yeah.
You know, I got suspended from school
that day. What was the fight about?
This black chick was trying to like fight me. This was a chick, this fucking ghetto ass chick. And I'm like, I'm not going to fight you. You're a chick. And then he pushed me into her. So then I turn around and I just fucking decked him because I had all this pent up like fucking anger.
Sure.
And when a chick hits you, it's like all you can do is cry. It really brings you back to when you're a kid, like your mom hit you, can't hit your mom.
Yeah, right.
You know what I'm saying? So when a chick hit you, when you can't do anything, you have this. So he just shouldn't have touched me at that moment. That was a bad idea.
Yes.
So I punched him in the face.
What a fucking asshole to do that, man.
Yeah,
what
dick move.
Asshole.
Cool guy though. He ended up being a cool guy like later. This is sixth grade. We're kids.
Yeah.
So I hit him and got suspended for a couple days, right?
Yeah.
That might have even been the fight that I got into, because I got into like 3 or 4 fights in Farley Middle School that got me sent to Havisham Middle School. It's a completely different school. Any one of those fights, if they didn't happen, I might not have gotten sent to Havisham Middle School. If I didn't go to Havisham Middle School, I wouldn't have met John Hickey, who became my best friend, who I ended up playing in a band with. That defined who I was from the 8th grade till fucking, you know, my first year of college. I was a musician. I was in a band producing shows, you know, putting on huge metal shows with Sworn Enemy and Coheed and Cambria. And it's like, dude, all of that. Think about that, dude. That fight with Paul Tamonti. If that didn't happen, I don't know if any of that would have happened. I wouldn't be sitting here right now. I truly believe that. If Paul Tamonti didn't push me into that girl, I wouldn't be sitting here right now, dude. I fucking wholeheartedly within my soul believe that. Okay, so thank you, Paul Tamonti. I wouldn't have my kid. You
Isn't
know,
that
so
amazing?
You go, that fucking asshole, but I go, nah, dude, fucking A, dude. That's the way it was supposed to happen.
That was God. That was God in disguise. That was God wearing the face of your friend. Yeah. No, one of the things that I've been taught is one way to look at things, not that this is true or not true, you maintain agnosticism, but one way to look at everything is just God wearing different masks, teaching you. And so your outlook is so beautiful because it's the opposite of victim mentality. A victim, something like that happens to them and they think the exact same thing in reverse, which is if he hadn't pushed me, then I wouldn't have gone to this fucked up school, you know, and then my life wouldn't have gone downhill. But with someone like you, somehow, and I want to figure out how, you've transformed a childhood that a lot of people would use as an excuse to be a complete motherfucker for their entire lives into some kind of beautiful trampoline that launched you into fatherhood and also into like having a really great comedy career and podcasting career. That's really beautiful. But when did it start? Was this just like some genetic thing inside of you? When do you remember in your childhood the moment you were like, I'm not going to let this destroy me?
I don't know if it was ever as clear, you know, as that, right? It was like, I was very independent from a very young age, I remember. And I remember...
You had to be independent, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know that there was like a specific moment that kind of... that I can kind of like nail down that made me go like, oh, well, I'm not going to let this fucking... There's moments like, I remember like, I talked about this on other shows, so I do apologize if, you know, my fans are, you know, hearing me getting repetitive about any of this stuff. But, you know, I remember there was a moment that I could pinpoint the moment where I like became like industrious and I was like, oh, where I like running my own thing.
Yeah. Because
I was always the kid to have my own like iced tea stand. Dude, summer would hit, iced tea lemonade stand. I'd offer both options, three sizes. I mean, dude, I'm like, I was that kid, dude.
How old were you?
You know, as young as six. I don't know, like five.
Wow.
I don't remember ever a time not making, going out and trying to make money.
Did your mom teach you this? Where did it come from?
No, my mom wasn't industrious at all. My mom was smoking cigarettes, falling asleep on methadone in her bed. You know what I'm saying? Like, I didn't want to be that. It was a weird thing.
It's just hard for me to imagine a six-year-old. Usually it's like you pick it up from somewhere, right? Would you see it on TV or something? Like, where did it occur to you, I've got to figure out a way to start taking care of myself because I don't have a mom and I don't have a dad and I got to figure this shit out. My mom.
I just didn't have things, and I envied the kids in my neighborhood who had things. And I grew up in a very white trash type neighborhood that was like lower middle class to really poor.
Right.
Like block to block, it was like, it could be like fucking welfare to like the best case scenario, like lower middle class where they'd own like a split level house.
Okay.
Right. And but you know, even those people were a little bit trashy. Like the people that owned the house, they weren't like, you know, but in my mind, anybody who owned a house was like fucking rich.
Yeah.
When I, at that age, at six or seven, if you owned a home, you were like, holy fuck. Like, wow, dude, you own a home. I could never imagine.
I'm still like that.
Yeah. How somebody could get enough money and get all their shit together to like $500,000. Are you crazy?
It's astounding.
That was always very like crazy to me. So I think that I don't know, man. I remember it was those moments, those really early moments where I'm watching my mom just kind of be a loser and just kind of going like, yeah, I don't want to fucking be that. I don't want to like just the embarrassment of walking away. I don't know if you grew up poor, but when your mom pulls out food stamps and you literally leave while she's paying because you don't want your friends from middle school or elementary school to see your mom paying with food stamps, you know, that was kind of a motivating factor for me.
Yeah, I wasn't that poor. We definitely, our family was like, for the first few years, we certainly weren't doing, I mean, like, you know, I wasn't food stamps poor. I think we were probably lower class for the first 10 years of my life or something, probably, but I can remember saying to my mom, and this is when I knew we were poor. I said, Mom, are we rich? And she looks at me and she goes, well, we're rich in spirit, Duncan. I'm like, we're fucking broke.
What does that mean?
It means you're broke. It means you're fucking
broke. She said she's rich in spirits. She was drunk, Duncan. She was hammered. She said, get out of my room, baby. Mom's getting happy.
Yeah, man. But the kind of poor you're talking about.
Yeah.
That's like the real deal. Yeah. That's the real deal, man.
And that's what we get. It was like iced tea lemonade stand. It was like, you know, winter would roll around. I was shoveling people's driveways. I would rake up leaves. I would do whatever it was because I didn't have like, you know, I didn't have somebody to like buy me things. Like now that I look at my kid, he's got so many fucking toys. I mean, I remember just having a few like kind of like tattered toys. My Transformers that I had, you know, that one double-headed gray Transformer where the legs were, it was a double, it turned into a double-headed dragon, right?
Yeah.
And it was the dude, the face of the dragons flipped up and those were his legs.
Yeah.
So I remember this dragon so fucking
Wait,
well.
Wait, you mean Voltron? That's not Voltron.
It was Transformer.
Okay.
Definitely a Transformer. It was a dragon Transformer. They had the
gotcha.
Spin-off fucking whatevers,
okay.
right? And I used to make that guy fuck my sister's Barbie all the time. Like, if you know the Barbie's legs don't split, so you have to do the double legs up, which is a good move now. Now that I'm an adult, like, it didn't seem realistic. As a kid, I was like, who would fuck that the way? But you're like, no, that's actually a pretty decent move. Like, knees together, legs up on one shoulder. So, but I remember, dude, I had that fucking Transformer for like 3 years. That was my main toy. Dude, I had like four or five of those big rubber, you know, WWF, you know, wrestlers.
Yeah, sure.
And those, those were my fucking toys for years. And that didn't seem like crazy. I love those toys, you know, but now I look back, I was like, no, my kid gets new toys all the time. He gets new books all the time, new clothes. My mom didn't read to me. I don't ever remember ever being read to once in my entire
wow.
fucking life. Not a single time do I remember a person sitting me down, putting me to bed, and reading me a story. My kid, every night, my kid could fucking, my kid, you should hear me, I have the worst voice. I sing my kid to bed every single night I put him to bed. Every single night.
What do you sing to him?
I sing him Unanswered Prayers by Garth Brooks.
How does that go?
Oh, boy.
Let's just hear it.
Just the other night at my hometown football game, my wife and I ran into my old high school flame. And as I introduced them, the past came back to me. And I couldn't help but think of the way things used to be.
Oh, does he sing it with you?
Yeah.
Oh, that's
he fucking
sweet.
Loves it, dude.
That's the sweetest thing I ever heard. Man.
I bought him Green Eggs and Ham yesterday. Came in the mail. Oh, dude. You know, I mean, the first time you read Green Eggs and Ham, I mean, it's fucking, dude. This kid lost his shit. He's never really read Dr. Seuss.
Oh, shit.
So he's about to go into a whole other world.
So he has no immune system for Dr. Seuss.
Oh, no, dude. And look, he already hates Jews, so we're halfway there.
Dr. Seuss is an anti-Semite?
I think he was, right? I think that was like part of the thing. Who was that? Walt Disney.
That
I think they
sucks.
Were all anti-Semites.
All of our heroes. We're losing all our heroes. Dr. Seuss, Harvey Weinstein, we're losing all our heroes.
Did Harvey Weinstein hate Jews? Is that what he did? I haven't been watching the news lately.
No, you haven't been watching the thing with Harvey Weinstein?
No, I have, obviously.
So, man, this is... So you're industrious from a young age.
Oh, but that's right. I was going to make this point. I remember it was like a moment. Like my neighbor died. A guy that lived in my neighborhood died. And his family was moving all of the stuff out to like the curb to be picked up by like trash collection, right? And me and this other kid in the neighborhood just took everything that was being collected and put it, and we just moved it over to my yard. I was seven. My mom was at work and we moved it over to my yard. And we did a yard sale in my yard and we made like $100 in a day.
Wow.
And when you're like 7 or 8 years old with $100, dude, I mean, it was literally just, you just buy candy and shit.
What was your mom saying about this?
My mom was very impressed when she came home. You know, she was, my mom at that time was, she wasn't like a shitty mom. Like she tried, she literally tried. Like she was the leader of my Boy Scout troop. She like took me to like little league, you know, karate classes. Like my mom did all the suburban mom bullshit. You know, she's had fucking demons. It got the best of her.
She was struggling with one of the most disastrous addictions that can happen to you.
Fucking a Puerto Rican. They warned her. It was not going to end well.
Did you think you were going to be a comedian?
No. No. I didn't even know, like, what comedy really was. You didn't, when you're, you know, a little kid, you don't, stand-up comedy is a very weird thing. Even step one, you know, what? Like, what the fuck do I do? What do you do? You know.
You remember the first comedy you heard?
I remember the first comedy I heard, but I, like, how would I do that?
What
like,
was it?
When you're a kid, the earliest comedy I could remember, like, really enjoying and laughing at, you know, was Eddie Murphy, Delirious.
Right.
That was, like, the first, like, comedy special. And there was no filter in my home in terms of like content. You know, I watched some pretty fucked up movies.
Anything.
I remember Clockwork Orange I watched when I was like 6 or 7. That rape scene, that gang rape scene, where like they're in front of the dude in the wheelchair, they're raping this old dude. I mean, as a 7-year-old watching that with your mom, going like, "Cool, I understand what gang rape in front of a man, in front of a husband is now."
What was your mom doing?
Booting up, probably. I don't know, Duncan. She wasn't paying attention. I know that much.
Your mom's shooting heroin on the couch while you watch rape.
Like I said, it wasn't that. Like, I didn't know she wasn't doing drugs at that time, but she fucked up. Like, no, she shouldn't let me watch those types of movies. You know, watching The Exorcist when I'm like 5 or 6. My kid gets scared of fucking, you know, if The Incredible Hulk smashes too hard in The Avengers. You know what I'm saying? Like,
but do you think this is, I mean, when I don't know what I was watching when I was 5 or 6. That is too young.
Yeah.
But I always wonder about like the impact that has on kids. And I wonder like how disastrous is it really for a kid to see some of that shit? Because it's like, if you introduce it to them in the right way, maybe, I don't know. I remember being terrified. Actually, now that I think about it, I remember being that age and someone could just tell me a ghost story and I would go into like a fear paralysis where I was just frozen in absolute terror. So yeah, I get it, man. I mean, this is a thing that I hear a bunch, which is people who have warped childhoods, non-standard, abusive, rough childhoods. It seems like they either make really great parents or they make the worst parents on earth.
It's either you run the opposite direction or you're a little bit better than your parents. And that's how my mom was. My mom would tell me stories as she was beating me up. This is how fucked up this is. And I'm very like, people hear me talk about this stuff and they're like, dude, but you know, it's, you know,
she would comedy, tell you stories.
Yeah. But you know, look, like we talk about this, how we do it. I mean, if I was sitting with a therapist, I would just be talking about this the same way. Trying to find funny in these stories, in my opinion, is even a much more therapeutic way to look at, you know, dark shit. You're trying to find the positive. You're trying to pull the positive out of these dark, fucked up things.
Yeah.
That is therapy fucking 10.0.
Absolutely.
That's like, fuck just talking about it and crying with a fucking napkin. No, bitch. I'm now trying to literally create a piece of positive content out of my fucked up childhood or life. So, you know, I don't think people should feel bad when they hear these stories. Just, you know, this is kind of how, you know, this is how I do it. I shouldn't say every comic. You know, it's you know, it is very therapeutic to kind of like talk about this shit.
It's like growing flowers on a baby grave.
Yeah, exactly. That's actually an interesting analogy.
Yeah. So yeah, go ahead. So your mom would beat you while she was telling you stories?
So yeah, she would fucking like literally, she'd be like, well, you don't know how bad I'd have it, you know? And then she would tell me stories. I remember from as early as I can remember, my mom told me that her stepdad raped her with an axe to her back. And I'm like, I would never put that on my kid. My kid would never have to deal with the levity of that in his childhood. He would, you know, as an adult, I might share that story with him later on. Like as a fucking fully functional, not even an 18-year-old adult, like a 25-year-old, hey dude, I've graduated college. Let me sit down and tell you about the world and some shit that I, you know, maybe even. I don't even know. I don't think so.
You want to hear something crazy, man?
Yeah.
So this is something I've been thinking about a lot, and some people were explaining this to me. So the concept here is trauma, right? And what you're talking about is trauma. And trauma is this contagion that travels through time from parents to kids. So, and you hear about this, you know, people who've been molested sometimes will become molesters, right? It's a contagion. And the same with trauma. People who have been abused will become abusers or have a higher probability of becoming abusers. So you can follow this echo of suffering probably thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years back to somebody maybe just having a bad fucking day.
Yeah, dude.
Some guy's having the best day.
Stepped
in dinosaur shit. He's like,
fuck!
Probably more like he saw like a bear carry his daughter off and eat her in front of him. And then he kind of went crazy and became an asshole. Now, this is where it gets really...
By the way, for us, like today, by today's standards, like as it relates, that's like iTunes going down for a day.
Oh, yeah.
You know, back then, it's like, it sucks.
You're having a bad fucking day.
It's a bad morning.
I saw my entire village was eaten by bears. But so what's interesting is this. There was an experiment that they did where they took mice and they exposed them to the smell of cherry blossoms while they were electrocuting them. And then the mice had little baby mice. And then they...
A little side note to ADD this up. We really just don't give a fuck about mice. Is there anybody advocating for what we do to lab rats and mice?
Dude, there's an actual... You can look it up. There's this very sweet statue. I don't know where it is, and it's dedicated to all the lab rats who've died for us.
Jesus.
And it's really sweet because so many of them have died. But you know, like...
Yeah.
We can do ADD, but this is actually... You ever read Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
No, I didn't.
So this... I've talked about this before because it's so fucking genius. But Douglas Adams said that mice were the end of the tentacles of interdimensional creatures who are sticking them into this dimension to study scientists, right?
Whoa.
So they exposed the baby mice to the smell of cherry blossoms, and they had a stress reaction to the cherry. So this is called epigenetics, and this is the idea that trauma gets in some way or another encoded into our fucking DNA.
And don't they say that, like, I just watched that one documentary about, like, dogs. Aren't dogs that much more susceptible to that type of, like, genetic, like, passing things on?
Probably.
Because they were, like, dogs are, like, the most genetically malleable mammals. Like, if you breed short-legged dogs, they're going to create a short-legged puppy. That's just, like, they're...
I know.
And that's why, like, you get aggressive dogs that have aggressive genes, and it's like, and you know... So, I, like, you know, dude... I don't fucking trust big fucking scary pit bulls or German shepherds, dude. Who fucking knows, dude? 3 generations ago, some asshole with a fucking black Yankees hat kicked this dog in the head, and it just fucking tears my throat out.
Yeah, well, this is the thing, man. Yeah. I mean, this is like, and I really love all of this stuff coming out right now, and I especially love it in the context of what you're talking about, which is that every single person has a chance to stop this avalanche of shit that's been pouring down from time into our current part of the time-space continuum. Because you look at a person and you're seeing the very tip of a river of genetics that stretches back to the time when we were proto-hominids. And this river of fucking genetics has been corrupted by trauma. Fucking World War II. The Industrial Revolution, the fucking
Limp Bizkit.
You're so Limp fucking Bizkit, dude, is destroyed. Limp Bizkit is why we have Trump. It's part of it, dude.
It really is.
And it's
a collection of all of the trauma throughout history. But Limp Bizkit was one of the, you know, they'll have like little fucking just fucking things on the timeline. That's one of them.
No, Limp Bizkit is like the ocean, and all the trauma is rivers that just poured into this band, forming a capsule of horror. Well, but this is, so when somebody has this fucking thing, man, when somebody has the wherewithal or the good luck or the good sense or just the sheer existential fucking potency to be like, I'm not going to fuck up my kid in the way, I'm not going to put my kid through that. I'm not going to continue playing this game of hot potato with a piece of Satan's shit, which is what's been going on for so long. Then it's what you do for the world is so incredible, because you're stopping something that has the potential of destroying the planet.
You have no idea how much you're speaking my language right now. And I'll obviously I won't shine the light on myself. You know, I preach about this all the time, and I get very preachy about it. And I think if there's one thing you're going to preach about, this is one of the things, dude. You know, I don't hit my kid. I never have, never even smacked him on the hand. I practice my own version of peaceful parenting. Peaceful parenting, by definition, they get a little fucking crazy, I think, some of them, but I don't hit, I don't speak to my son aggressively. He's never been yelled at by me. Like, he's seen me get upset. He's seen me get angry at other things, but it's never been at him. You know, we don't use intimidation. We don't use a threat. Even parents that don't hit, or the ones they go, well, we spank once in a while, the looming threat is just, you know, always there, right? And I think that is a very big part of what's wrong with people today and where a lot of the violence is coming from in society. I think people are, we're hitting babies. You're hitting little babies, dude. You're smacking little one-year-olds on the hand. You're using aggression. You're speaking to them aggressively. And it programs them to interact with people that way. I watch my son. My son walks like me. He talks like me. Dude, he is mimicking every movement, everything around him. Like, and for people to deny that, you know, striking a child for not acting the way that you want them to act before they're old enough to compute, you know, what's right, wrong, whatever it is, that doesn't program them a certain way, I think that they're ignoring a really big fact. And I think that, and it's a lot of people, and it, you know, I think something like 70% of people admit to spanking their kids, 75% as young as one. Those are people that are admitting it. I think the numbers are even more than that. I think it's a very, very small fraction of people that don't spank or don't believe in it. I get a lot of pushback online when I talk about it. I get people that, you know, I've never... The most controversial thing I say on the internet is don't hit your kids. I have people coming at me.
Wow.
Like, dude, I say on podcasts, I say the N word and the F word and anywhere. We don't give a shit, dude. We try to push the envelope as far as possible.
What's the N word?
nigger?
What?
Nigger?
What?
Say it, Duncan. You can say it.
I'm not saying the N word.
You wouldn't say it?
No. Fuck.
Just hold on. For the context of just we're saying you're. All right. Say this. The word nigger is a word.
I can't say it.
Shut up. Yes, you can.
No way.
It is, though.
I'm not racist.
You're not racist.
You are, though.
No, I'm not.
Listen to what you just said.
The word nigger is a word?
You're a fucking Nazi.
Oh, shit.
You're a racist.
That's the new N-word.
Fucking Nazi. You make me sick. How could you say such a fucking thing? No, you know what, man? Here's why I
Have
won't.
You ever ridden a subway in New York?
No, listen. Here's why I won't say it. Here's why I don't say it. I won't say it. Not that I give a fuck that anyone says it.
Yeah.
And anybody who says it, from the most vile, festering racist to the most fucking hilarious Puerto Rican, awesome human I know, to me, it's a magical word. And... I think that it fucking, okay, let me give you an example. I used to not think like this, man. I'll give you an example. So I got my fucking ball chopped off. I got testicular cancer and I'm fine now. My mom died of cancer. So when I see comedians doing jokes about fucking cancer, or when I hear like real gross, flippant jokes about cancer, it triggers in me memories that are like uncomfortable, right? I don't like it to think about it too much. But that being said, I would never in 100 trillion billion years be like, hey, man, you shouldn't talk about that on stage, man. That's fucked up. But that being said, I recognize the specific like weird fucking tone it hits with me. So I think similarly,
of course,
the word nigger produces I think it what it does is it produces like a
visceral reaction,
because when I hear that word, it's way different than when a black person hears that word.
Have you ever heard it? I mean, you have. I've heard it. I mean, I've had it thrown at me by family members, like Italian Irish family members, that like my grandma said, I remember, young memory, it's not his fault he's a nigger. I remember. Yeah. It was crazy because I would get picked on in the neighborhood by the white kids. They would throw rocks at me and call me a nigger. And I would come home crying and upset that, you know, these kids were being so mean to me. And I this Italian-Irish household where they were like, yeah, you know, hey, they call you a nigger, but you don't act like a nigger then. I'm like, okay.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's different. I'm white, yeah. Obviously. So it's like...
But have you ever hear it like in like a real like racist context? Like,
I grew up in the South.
So you know, exactly. We do these jokes. People don't even get it. Like, we're so... just trying to be funny in everything we do. Even if it doesn't hit, I think sometimes when a racist quote-unquote joke doesn't hit, there's this like almost same awkward tone of like, oh my God, that was racist. Like, no, it just didn't. It was a misfire. When you hear real racism, when you're at a bar and you hear some other guy goes like, I check out the fucking nigger over there, that makes me feel like disgusted.
Yeah.
That's like, you know, that, but it's really, it's the context is what's making me feel disgusted. It's not the word at all. The words themselves. And, you know, it speaks to your point where you said, like, you know, you feel slightly triggered and uncomfortable if people do a cancer joke. You almost kind of like, you know, brings you to a place.
It makes you feel bad.
But shouldn't comedy, I understand the point of comedy is supposed to be, you know, to make people laugh. But shouldn't comedy take you on a little bit of that journey?
No, comedy gets, yeah, absolutely. And that's, and again, like I say, I recognize, to me, that's the beauty of the thing.
Yeah.
There is absolutely.
It's like Patrice O'Neill. Like, I didn't agree with anything Patrice said, but he was the most brilliant comic, and I thought he was better because of it, because he took you on a journey.
No rules behind it all. But then the other side of it, aside from, like, the journey of, like, just having to deal with it. Let me tell you, getting offended, it's a delight. Like, if I find myself authentically offended, like, oh, man.
Wow.
That's a great moment. Like, wow, that's incredible. How'd you manage to? That's fucking awesome. The offense is like, usually it's just like, the other side of comedy though, is you reflect what you think is comedic and what you want to say and what's really funny. And I just know, like, when it comes to like racial shit, I don't know. It's just like not my ball of fucking putty. I'm not into it. I don't like, I think, you know, when I like say it, I don't know. I can't, to me, it's because it's not sparking something in me that's like, yeah, that's pretty fucking hilarious. I just don't do it.
Yeah. I just grew up with such a, because I'm mixer, I'm half Puerto Rican, half Italian Irish, right? I grew up in an Italian Irish household. My dad was murdered when I was four. The Puerto Rican influence in my life was basically gone after he was murdered. Right. I just grew up in this sort of hilarious world where racism was a very, very big part of where I grew up, how I grew up, what I kind of dealt with every single day. I mean, I dealt with some real deal racism. When I hear white people tell me that I cannot use certain words that have racial implications, I'm like, motherfucker, are you crazy? Have you ever been hit in the face with a rock and been called a nigger?
Right.
Back the fuck up.
There you go.
Don't tell me what I can
exactly.
say.
Exactly.
You know, so that experience, I do think it gives you a little bit more of a right. I have carte blanche because I'm, you know, I am brown. I think on the surface.
No pun intended, carte blanche. You do have that. Yeah.
You know, but it's like, I think that people, you know, look, I was raised by white people. I get this all the time. People are like, well, you're not really Puerto Rican because you were raised by Italian Irish people. You don't listen to hip hop music. You don't dress like you're a thug. You know, I grew up on metal music. I grew up on Poison and like Skid Row. Like that was like the shit that I liked when I was like 8 or 9. Like, you know, I had a sister who was a couple years older than me. So I didn't have that, like, the same journey as the typical Puerto Rican kid growing up in the Bronx. But I think that because of that, I have a much different insight on racism and race than even those kids in the Bronx.
Yeah, man, we don't, you do. And it's like, you know, people like, get really like white, some white dudes will get really like adamant about their right to say whatever they want to say, to say the N word as much as they want. And it's like, go ahead, dude, say it all you fucking want. Like, just say it until you're fucking blue in the face. Wow. You're so fucking edgy. Wow. Yeah. Congratulations. But it's like, it's not funny. And literally not fun. You know what I mean? It's not like, it's not funny because I'm like trying to apply ethics to comedy. What, it's not funny because what's coming out just feels like a kind of, have you ever heard the term edgelord?
Yes.
So that's what that is. It's edgelording. It's like, you're just trying to be this like fucking, oh, sorry about
that. No, I like that, dude. It's actually better.
You're just trying to be a fucking thing that's like standing at the fucking, I'll fix that. You're just trying to be a thing that's like being rather obvious in your choice of like language, where it's like, what does it really fucking do? And also, P.S., it's like, man, I mean, this is all, I'm going to be fucking really honest, man. I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about this shit until like some of my friends started explaining it to me. And then I was kind of like, as they're explaining, a little resistant in the beginning, where I'm like, what are you talking about? And then the more I thought, they're like, dude, Duncan, like, just fucking think about it, man.
Yeah.
Think about your experience in life. You know what I mean? You don't know what it's like to actually, like you said, get fucking hit in the face while you're being called a nigger. You don't know what that's fucking like. You have no idea. Anytime you've heard that word, it's coming out of the mouth of one of your fucking relatives in the South. You know what I mean? And it's like, so you have no, there is no twinge.
But the thing that I say, and obviously you're not talking about, you know, taking the words off the table. You're saying it's your personal
choice.
As a personal choice, as an entertainer, like you're like, you know, dude, I don't need to go there because that's not. And that's, I think that's admirable. And I think that's obviously you're right. We kind of loop back around to kind of the, you know, alternative comedy. I do think that a lot of those words, they're really difficult to get laughs with. You can't go up and say faggot anymore on stage and really get a laugh. It's really hard. I remember I have a joke. I have a joke that I talk about how, you know, it was when I first had my kid, I wrote this. I was like, I used to say that I wouldn't care if my son was gay, but, you know, I took my dog to the park recently and he started humping this other male dog and the dog's owner started fucking him. He was like, yo, son, your dog's a faggot. And I, you know, that was, and then I go into whatever, right?
Yeah, that's cool.
So, but the word faggot, I had to take out of that joke because I would say faggot and the audience would be laughing at, like, they're laughing at the setups and I'm hitting these little punches. And then I'd get to that word and the audience would shut down and they go, whoa.
That's depressing.
You know, and then I go, all right, well, I have to change it and I have to pivot. It's my job to kill. It's my job to get booked again at that club. But it's also, I believe, you know, my job, you know, and what we do with Legion of Skanks and kind of the brand over at Gas Digital, the podcast network that I run. At this point, it's almost become like, you know, part of our brand and part of our responsibility to see how far we can push the line with keeping it hilarious and palpable for everybody in the room.
That's it.
Big J Oakerson, you know, say what you want about him. Dude, he says every word under the sun and he is one of the funniest motherfuckers on the planet.
Super funny.
He will, dude, I watched him, we were at the roast battle and he used the N-word judging. And he fucking killed. And I was like, dude, no, I don't know many people who can use the N-word, a white guy, in a comedy club, 2017, and fucking have the audience rolling.
Dude, that guy's fucking incredible. And again, let me just emphasize this, man, in case there's any question out there and people are listening. To me, comedy transcends ethics. Comedy transcends morality. Mm. Comedy transcends any kind of social construct and the zeitgeist determining what is the right way to be or the wrong way to be. Comedy is the spirit of Loki, of chaos, and cannot be chained by the fucking ethical systems of the people. And the moment comedians start letting themselves get chained down by that fucking system of ethics, then at that point, they are no longer fucking comedians. At that point, they become something a little different. But again,
satirist or whatever.
I don't know what it fucking is. But what I'm trying to get across is we should use all colors in our palette. So what I'm saying is if something popped into my head, which was an authentic, hilarious use of that fucking word,
you would do it.
Fuck yeah, I do.
Yeah, goddamn right.
But the point is,
it pop in your head.
I haven't thought of anything funny in years.
Yeah. So just cross the board. Yeah, dude, I'm out. Well, if you look at clean comics, like Nate Bargatze, like people don't even realize that he is squeaky clean. Like has never cursed into a microphone. Has never, like, that's like, he, like, on podcasts, he was like, dude, I won't even, like, curse. Maybe he said bullshit or something on a podcast, like, getting hammered or something. Yeah. But that's as far as it's ever gone. And he's got, you know, a few hours of material, squeaky clean, super palpable. And, you know, we've talked about it so much. You know, my agent's like, yeah, dude, you know, I'd love to get you on some of these corporates. How long can you go clean? I'm like, 6 minutes? I don't know, dude. What are you? How long you need? I can lie. You know, and Nate, you'll go do an hour on these corporates, and he makes a lot of money doing it.
Bet.
Like a ton of fuck. He said to me, he was like, you know, dude, he's like, man, worst case scenario, I'll just do these corporate gigs, you know. And then he told me how much money he makes on them. I was like, that's your worst case scenario? I will suck a dick right now. Literally, I would suck a dick for the amount of money he makes on each corporate. I really mean that. I'm not gay. So, excuse anyone doesn't know.
That's either a lot of money or not that
much. Or I'm really into sucking dick.
Yeah.
Turns out I just love sucking dick. 500 bucks.
It's like $500. Yeah.
No, but his mind, he doesn't think dirty. His mind doesn't go there. His mind very much thinks of these things, and it's not a thing for him to try. When I'm trying to do like a late night tape, it's a nightmare, dude. Like, my mind doesn't think that way, and I'm editing my jokes, and I'm pulling words out, and you're getting an edited, you know, not for people that don't know, a comedian, you know, the reason that comedians do best in their home club It's because they're most comfortable, dude. When you're comfortable, you're from the gut. You're in the moment. You can say whatever you want. You know you're not going to get fired if you bomb because the booker loves you. They're your friend at this point. You've been working there for years.
Yes.
That's where you get this amazing, incredible comedy out of somebody. It's not in theater in their first half hour Comedy Central special. It's not late night where they're nervous as shit. That is like...
Or where they've had to give a fucking sheet of their jokes to a panel of censors who go through every fucking
word
line.
By word. Got to take that out. Got to take that out.
That is Lucifer. That's like, can you fucking imagine all the great artists having to go to a bureaucratic panel of people reflecting the will of the state before they could paint the thing that had come into their minds?
It's crazy.
Can you fucking imagine what that would look
before
like?
Before they could showcase their art. And then you would literally go, imagine them going, all right, well, you know what, dude? We're only using the 8 colors in that Crayola box. That's it.
Yeah.
Now, look, is that a skill set? Is that something incredible to be able to do? Of course. But it's not the nitty-gritty balls, what the fuck is funny about Duncan Trussell or Luis J. Gomez.
I love that you want to paint Mona Lisa. And I think it's fantastic. But does she have to be in dark color? Like, let's brighten up the thing a little bit. Can we brighten it up? You could barely see her smile. Make her fucking grin.
Yeah, I want to see those pearly whites.
I want to see those teeth.
See, Colgate is one of our sponsors, and we really need to show some teeth right now.
But this is, and I think this is a good way to wrap it around, because I know you got to go. This is something that I love about the Skanks and all of you guys and what you represent when it comes to comedy is that when you consider that up until this point, the main way to reach the people through comedy was either going on the road and then having albums or getting on TV. But then here's where it gets sinister, because the rules that people have been abiding by up until recently with network television have been rules that have been prescribed by the state. Then what ends up happening is the state gets in between the people and art, in between the people. So people have been seeing propaganda. Now, it might not seem like propaganda. They're like, what do you mean? Just because, like, you can't say fuck or pussy or shit or whatever?
No. You can't get a late night set if you are not, if you are praising Trump in any way. You're not getting on late night, period. You're not.
Now, this is this effect. For better, this effect is always for the worse. And so what ends up happening is people begin to become attuned to a very specific type of media that is media that has been warped by the state.
And it's also comfortable, right? So that people love routine. So anything that deviates from that specific thing, they go, I don't even like that. And then they realize it's like a subconscious thing,
they've
but they go,
programmed.
Ooh,
they've
that's
been
uncomfortable.
Programmed.
Yeah.
They've been programmed.
That anti-programming,
it's conditioned.
They don't even realize that, like, it's not even the words, whatever it is, it's how it's packaged. It's why every TV show is the same. It's why every late night talk show starts the same, ends the same. It's because that routine, if you deviate from that routine, you know, why we don't need to start television shows at the exact same time every single in the same way. Not every fucking reality show needs to have the exact same structure, but they know that the way the human mind works is routine makes people very comfortable. It makes people go like, oh shit, I feel like I'm at home. And that's why everybody in their life, they go through these cycles. So anybody who goes to a therapist, you're going to come to the conclusion that you're doing these stupid cycles.
Yeah, right.
And you break them all down. And that's comfortable. Even if it's bad habits, even if it's stupid shit, smoking cigarettes every day, right? It's this comfortable thing that you're doing every single day. And when you don't have it, I remember when I first stopped smoking cigarettes, I was like, what am I going to do with my hand? I was like, I need to. It was so uncomfortable and just not have that. It wasn't even the fucking smoke anymore. It was just the routine.
But which is super fucking cool about your podcast and what you guys are doing. See, I'm not saying you guys are like, you know, saving planet Earth or anything that's so lofty, but just the very act.
We are, though.
I know.
You should know, though, because here's what we did. This is where we get fucking so silly. This is that we were in, you know, LA last week and we did that show at the Comedy Store. And then, like, we're just at dinner, and we're on cloud nine. Jay had just done Conan, and everyone's feeling really good. And, you know, this Puerto Rico shit was going on. You know, somebody tweeted at me. They were like, you guys haven't said anything about Puerto Rico. So, like, you know what? I'm like, dude, the Comedy Store show's tomorrow night. Dude, what? And this in front of everybody. Dave did not want to do this at all. Jay barely wanted to do this. But there's a bunch of people, like agents, all these people. I was like, we should donate the money from the Comedy Store show tomorrow night to Puerto Rico. And then Dave's like, all of it? I'm like, yeah, all of it. And everyone's like, yeah. I was like, And then everyone's like, I guess we're going to do that now. So we made three grand that night. On the Thursday night, we did a stand-up show in the main room, then a podcast in the belly room. But then, check this out. You're going to love this because you fucking, you get into, you know, the just using the fucking business for good sometimes. The podcast we recorded, I was like, well, why don't we just put that up for pay-per-view on Gas Digital?
There you go.
Right? Because people won't buy podcasts, but yeah. If you donate a few bucks, you know, we'll give you the podcast. You know, we're going to put it out for free eventually sure. One day. So we've made another like $6,000 already. We're probably cut it off at like $10,000. We're going to donate $10,000 to Puerto Rico. So yeah, you can say our N-word jokes are saving the world, Duncan.
And I can feel it. And that's what's so fucking cool about it. And this is why it's just such a beautiful thing to have. And it's really fucking inspiring. That's awesome. Fucking $10,000.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And here's the cool part of all of it, though. The thing that I'm like, you know, I take out of all of it, you know, fuck Puerto Rico, no offense. But I think that's such an incredible lesson to learn. Like, wait a minute, hold on, time out. We don't have to raise money. And we're not a huge podcast. We have a following. But you can do a fucking charity benefit without having to get 8 big comics together in yes. A big theater. And, you know, to raise $10,000... You know, it would take a whole night and everybody's schedules yeah. And get everything together. You can just say, hey, dude, you know what? I'm going to do a podcast. You know, you sit down with fucking Ari Shaffir. Today, we're going to donate the money to the Las Vegas family victims. Yeah. $5 a pop, you buy it. You know, you donate it. I mean, we did it $2 for the audio, $5 for the video and the audio. And then for $20, we give you a special thank you on air. And we're just going to keep it open for about a week. I think we've done like $6,000 so far on the pod.
You are a filthy angel, and I'm so glad you exist.
The
angel is
a great way to fucking describe
it. Sounds like the name of a porn company.
Yeah.
But hey, thank you so much, Louis.
Thank you, brother.
This is awesome, man. Where can people find you?
GomezComedy.com for all the live dates. When does this come out?
This will probably come out either this week or next week.
So if it comes out next week, October 22nd, I'll be in Detroit. You guys can get tickets at GomezComedy.com. I'm with my buddy Justin Silver, coming out to Chicago, coming out to Buffalo. Lots of road stuff happening. I got 3 podcasts, Legion of Skanks, Real Ass Podcast, and then Believe You Me, which is with the UFC middleweight champion, Michael Bisping.
Cool.
And yeah, we're all on GasDigitalNetwork.com, which is the podcast network that I run with my business partner.
Beautiful. Thank you, Mr. Gomez.
Duncan, you the man.
You the man. That's great. Thanks for listening, everybody. That was Louis J. Gomez. I'll have all the links you need to find him over in the comments section of this episode at DuncanTrussell.com. Much thanks to those of you who have subscribed to us at Patreon. Remember, it's at patreon.com/DTFH. And thank you all for continuing to listen to this podcast. We've got a great episode coming up with the legendary Alexi Wasser. That'll be out this Friday, hopefully. Until then, may God be with you. Hare Krishna.